Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so I'm here with my guest, Aaron. Aaron, I was flustered when I came in just now. We had a little bit of pre-record time. And you know what I didn't tell you? Why? What? I was late.
Why?
Because we decided on a whim today to go see Wicked.
Oh my gosh. I'm so happy for you.
I actually thought you might be. I was like, oh my goodness.
What did you think?
Oh, I had a lot of feelings, but okay, you want to know the most profound, the most deep feeling?
Yes,
I had?
Yes, I do.
Ariana Grande crushed.
She crushed it.
Crushed the whole.
No, like, I don't love her. She's not my favorite, but no. I got to give it to you. Like, you killed that.
I mean, she killed it. Like, she
absolutely
killed it. And yeah, I'm the same. I'm like, I'll sing along if, like, there's a song on the radio. I have teenage daughters, you know, so of course, like, we're going to sing Ariana Grande.
Yeah.
But like, I just didn't even know.
No. Well, you know, like, she took acting lessons.
I had no idea.
She took acting lessons for this for like a year solid. Like during the pandemic, she was like, that's what she did. She just hunkered down and did acting lessons because they were like, well, you know, you can kill the vocals, but like, if you really want to be in contention for this, you got to sharpen those acting skills. So,
well, she did it.
She really did it. I know. Yeah.
I mean, she did. So anyway, so that is why I came in flustered late. It's one of those, you know, we live in Houston. It's like, okay, we're recording this right now, like before Christmas. And so I'm like, what's normally a 7-minute drive?
Yes.
Then it was like a 15. I didn't do the math right in my head to begin with and all this stuff. And I was like, it's going to be so close. So anyway, thanks to her grace.
Oh,
I'm coming in flustered, but I got to see Wicked.
I know. And really that was like, we don't need any other further, you saw Wicked. That's what you needed to do today. So if you were a couple minutes late, it doesn't matter.
That's what I need. That's what my soul needed for me to see Wicked today.
I know.
Probably by now people have figured it out. I'm sitting here with Aaron Hicks Moon. I am thrilled that I got to see Wicked. I am equally, probably in fact, more thrilled that I'm sitting here with you to talk about this book. Because I laughed my butt off.
I'm so glad. That really makes me happy. I really wanted to write a book about deconstruction that did not take it seriously, but not like myself or anyone else too seriously.
Oh, I laughed my butt off. Now I'm feeling real ill prepared because we've done this already. Okay, so this is coming out the beginning of February 4th.
February 4th, yeah.
2025 is called I've Got Questions, The Spiritual Practice of Having It Out with God by Aaron Hicks Moon. Aaron, it's not that often that I get to talk to someone else who understands Texas.
Oh yes. And you listen, I understand, like, we are so specifically linked. Like, there's a little part of the panhandle of Texas and the Southern Oklahoma that we understand each other.
Yes.
I don't know that we like there's a unsteady peace between the two of us. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, we're like, Oklahomans don't trust Texans and Texans don't trust Oklahomans.
100%.
But
that's right.
In this area, it's like, begrudgingly, I will offer you my respect. Yes.
That's right. That's right. And I refer to Oklahoma, actually, because I've been in Texas now for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell anyone. I say there's only a few cities in Texas I would live in.
Uh-huh.
Houston is one of them.
Okay. You're braver than me.
Houston terrifies me. I mean, Houston, my biggest fear in Houston is teaching my kids to drive here.
Oh God. Yes. I could not imagine.
I mean,
frankly,
we're not there yet, but we're very, very close.
Yeah.
And it does terrify me. And I will say that it terrified me from the moment my daughters were born.
You were like, I'm going to have to do this.
I'm going to have to do this in 16 years. So I've been holding that for, for all of this time. Like,
it's going to come out. It's all going to get released this year. So
I think that's why they were like, Dad can teach us.
Dad, let's let dad do this. You know? And I'm like, well, wouldn't you love that? But it's probably not going to happen. But sure. When I moved here, I realized, because I did a couple of years in college in San Antonio, and I loved
San Antonio. San Antonio.
Isn't it so great? It's just so such great. A great city. Mm-hmm. But I, when I lived here, like for real, I was like, oh, Oklahoma. Now, don't tell the other Oklahomans. Oklahoma is really just Diet Texas. Right?
It's so brutal.
It's like
that is exactly what every Texan would tell you. So I know that we have like thoroughly gotten you over to our own side.
It is. It's just Diet Texas. It's like not quite the flavor. It's not quite the punch, you know, but mm-hmm. you want to be. And you say like Diet Coke, like we taste just like regular Coke.
It's the same. It's just the same.
In fact, some people prefer Diet Coke.
Yes, that's true.
And the Coke people say, not exactly.
It's not the same. It's not exactly the same.
Yeah. So you're right. I think Oklahoma is really just a bit Diet Texas-y.
That's so funny.
But I'm saying that because I'm reading your book and I'm like, Erin, we grew up in the same church.
We had to.
We grew up in the same church. The carpet was the same. The pews were probably the same. Mm-hmm. The in remembrance of table was probably the same one. Mm-hmm. We just, you know, rotated it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the same. Yeah. And when I was reading this, I thought, but it's not just me and Erin.
No, absolutely not. It's really not at
There's
all.
A whole lot of us out there who grew up in the same church. So that is kind of where I almost want to start is like when you were writing this and you wanted, as you mentioned, to write a book that took the subject seriously, but not like yourself or, I mean, I would say I didn't feel like I could take myself too seriously when I was reading this book. I was really grateful for that.
I'm glad.
But I think like, so am I your audience? Is it me? Is it the people who grew up in your mustard carpet SBC-ish church? Who is it? And then like, really, what's your hope for us? Because I'm kind of feeling like the audience might be wide. I definitely was included in it. And I can share with you, and hopefully I will during this podcast, like how the book kind of touched me. But I'm curious, when you were writing it, like what was your hope for us?
I think my hope was essentially freedom. I, for so long, felt so boxed in by what I was quote unquote supposed to believe. And I don't know that anyone ever like specifically said that to me, like you need to believe these specific things in order to be a productive Christian. But there were boundaries that someone had set up, maybe partially me, maybe partially other people, that did not allow me really to walk in any kind of freedom in my own faith. And so I think what I hope is that I hope people feel empowered, that their questions are not only valid, but important. The things that they doubt, that means something. And that following that curiosity will bring you closer to God. I really do believe that. You said it's not just us. It's absolutely not just us. I talk with people all the time, DMs, email, offline, and they are reckoning with what they believe. Either they have seen what the public witness of Christianity is in the United States right now, and that doesn't fit with what they understand about the Gospels and Jesus, or they've had all these questions for so long, or they're getting married and they're dealing with purity culture and like the backlash for that. There's so many people that are dealing with things like this. And I think, I hope that that anyone who reads this finds a new practice that doesn't bypass those curiosities and that anger and those real feelings, but engages with God in order to be loved and be known and be, you know, fully to love and be fully loved, I think. And, you know, the kingdom of God doesn't just belong to people who have got it all figured out. Jesus is very specific about that in the Sermon on the Mount. He's like, it belongs to the doubters and the curious and the poor in spirit and the confused and the frustrated. It's as much yours as it is anyone else's.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, there's so much there, but this like, you know, when you say you don't know if you ever explicitly told that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I mean, I feel like I was. I'll just like be
real. Yeah. I mean, I think I think in a way I was, but also even as I moved out of that, like, you know, got older and went to college and, you know, lived on my own, I think there were still, they were still invisible. It was like an invisible fence for me. It didn't really register that it was still there, but it was.
Yeah. 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 And I think for, I mean, part of my situation in that is that I have a personality that like tends toward rules and boundaries and things like that. Like I would say less now, but especially in my like childhood, teenage, you know, young adult, I'm like, that's kind of stuff. I loved it. Like it felt very clear to me. It kind of made me feel safe.
Oh, the, yeah.
Like, equation kinds of things, you know, if that, then this, you know, would happen or whatever it was. And it just felt good to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I started kind of going, wait a minute, and it was actually partially led to this podcast, actually, because I started just asking myself, like, what if, and this really was a big what if question for me. And I feel like for people listening, it maybe they may have gone through something similar, or maybe they are going through something similar, where I was like, what if it's not actually about having all of the like air quote right answers?
Sure. Yeah.
Like, what if this faith thing isn't about that? Mm-hmm. What if part of it is just asking better questions?
Yeah.
And that you're talking about, the curiosity, the doubting, you know, those kinds of things that felt very threatening to my faith when I was younger, and even into my adulthood, it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. There were things that felt very incongruent, but still the question asking was very intimidating for me. I didn't feel like there were a lot of folks around me who were asking questions and starting to do those kinds of things. And so one of the things that hit me when I was reading your book, because you share a lot of your story in it, which is so great, but as I'm wondering, like, what has that meant for you? You know, like, as you've been going through whatever, I'll let you describe kind of how, you know, we named deconstruction in general earlier, but like, as you've been going through your own faith, journey, we don't have anything to drink. I tried to avoid it so much,
okay.
But I can't.
It's okay. You can't, really. It's not possible. That's why I had to make a joke out of it.
So as you've been going through your faith journey, drink something now, like, what has it meant to you to have people who have been alongside of you, whether they were like supporting you or also like fellow question askers or like people that you felt like could encourage you and accompany you as you were, you know, moving through that? I don't know. I'm just wondering if you can talk about like what parts of that were meaningful for you, or why was that meaningful for you to have those folks?
Yeah, I think so much of this process is very isolating. The deconstruction, the evolution of your faith, it's enormously isolating. One, because it's personal and it's between you and God and Holy Spirit. And also it does unfortunately sometimes accompany the loss of community. I've talked to so many people in offline, online, who say things like, I asked too many questions and I got kicked out of my small group. And like that's real. Yeah. Or I asked a question and it was very clear that I was not wanted in this faith community anymore. And I really do feel like that is, personally, I believe that's one of the biggest obstacles people have to like making the decision to start like investigating their faith to really, because what, I mean, what did you say earlier? You said it felt very safe. There was a certainty and there's a comfort in that. No question about it. And loneliness is terrible. And loneliness while you're trying to unpack one of the most important parts of your soul is enormously unmooring. And so I think, you know, for me in the book, I just wanted to remind people that they weren't alone, that, and not lie about, hey, yeah, this might really suck. I mean, just like you might get kicked out of your small group. You might not have the same kind of relationship with people when they realize that you don't necessarily are not necessarily sticking with the things that you did. And, you know, people don't need someone with all the answers, and they wouldn't find that in me or anyone, frankly. But the presence, I think, just reminding people, like, there is someone with you. There is someone with you who loves you enough to let you work this out without needing you to be okay or to have all the right answers or to even come to a certain conclusion, I think is really important. And that's really what I wanted to offer with this was like, hey, there's no judgment in where you land here, but the work to get to where you're going to land. And by the way, we never really land. But in that work, like you have someone with you.
Yeah. I think that was part of what felt really good about these pages was I have had people close to me and I think sometimes you can just sense the fear of like, I don't know where I'm going to land, but yeah. I'm afraid if I land in the wrong spot, you know, like there are some people who are getting kicked out for asking the questions, but there are some people who are like, I'm asking the questions and I may stop asking the questions.
Oh, absolutely. And listen, it's not that I don't think that that's not a valid thing. Absolutely not. I understand the value of community. I understand what it means to be on the outside of something and what it means to be on the inside of something. And I think what is hard is even if you are like, I want to ask these questions, but I don't think I can because I don't think my relationships can sustain them. What you're going to have to deal with is the fact that that doesn't mean you shouldn't ask the questions. That's it technically right. means you need new relationships. And that's right. really hard, like really yeah. hard. And I don't ever want to act like that's an easy choice to make.
Right. But I mean, but part of what I was trying to say is I felt in your book though, this like a sense of like, here is at least one person, I may not know her personally, but here's at least one person who is saying to me, you know, I'm not going to judge you where you land. And this really is a personal thing. And not just like, I'm not going to judge you because I don't care.
Right.
But like I don't know, what I felt was like this faith to say like, I really believe that you and God, you like got this, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if God would really agree.
Like, I mean, like, you know, like I felt like as a reader, like Aaron saying, like, you got this, you know, like,
oh,
you,
yeah.
you can figure this out and God's with you and wherever you land. And you said you never really land. That kind of brings me to the, you had a couple of metaphors.
Yeah, just a few. I love a metaphor.
A couple of metaphors, and I love a metaphor too. But it really does feel, I think, going along with this, it kind of can feel like you mentioned at the beginning, this like this plastic bag situation where we're just mm-hmm. kind of like, you're not just floating around. When I see a plastic bag, it's not like all real graceful.
No.
In the parking no. lot. Like it's kind of jerky sometimes. Yeah. And
getting snagged on stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like
100%.
All of that. And I just kind of felt in these pages like this permission of like, here's somebody who's saying like, just let yourself go, you know, like let yourself ask the things, like yeah. move where you are feeling led to move and just yeah. see, because it can be scary and jagged and all those things.
And I think some of that, you know, the way we grew up, you know, was you can't trust yourself.
Yes.
Your heart is deceitful above all things. And while also simultaneously being like, hey, Jesus lives in your heart and you have Holy Spirit. So figure that out, I guess. And also you're 17. And so it's that act of understanding like, hey, just because I'm feeling it, it doesn't mean it's evil or wrong. Just because I'm asking a question, that doesn't mean that I don't believe the things that I used to believe. It doesn't mean that I'm going to go in this direction necessarily, but just having that like kind of arena space to walk around and go, okay, what's this? What's going on here? I got a question about this. This has made me really curious. What about the biblical inerrancy? What about women? You know, all of these things. I think giving yourself the space to do that, as opposed to just letting yourself be thrown in the wind to, you know, whoever told you whatever, when you were however, you know, whatever age, that's not a life. That's you just existing. And I do believe that Jesus says that we will have abundant life in him, that he has come to give us abundant life. And so the plastic bag metaphor was so real to me because that is how I felt before I was able to give myself the agency to work with Holy Spirit to start asking some of those questions.
What you just said reminded me years ago. So my husband and I have been married for like 100 years. It feels like 100 years of bliss, honey. Cause he's going to listen to this when he's producing
she
it.
You just wouldn't believe how hard she's smiling right now.
I'm smitten. But no, we've been married for forever and ever. And years ago, something that was very helpful for us, especially helpful for me, was that we have two different processing styles. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to think to talk.
Okay.
So I'm a very much an internal processor. Mm-hmm. Generally, I'm pretty extroverted and stuff, but like if I'm like thinking about something very serious or deep stuff or it's like affecting my person, mm-hmm. like no one in my life will hear about it probably for a long time because I just have to sit with myself. And for a long time. My husband, on the other hand, and this is where it came up for me, because when you're like, I may not even go in that direction, but I just kind of want to ask. He talks to think.
Oh, yeah.
And so, but I'm his conversation partner, like his primary conversation partner.
Yeah.
And so we'll sit at the breakfast, like, you know, our kids have gotten now where they're better about it. But I think for years, it was like they just hated Saturday mornings, you know, because mom and dad would just sit at the breakfast table for an unreasonable amount of time, have coffee and enjoy each other's company and talk and just talk. And he, when once I was able to learn this about him, and it took more than just him telling me, I had to really process what this means because I don't understand this kind of processing. He would talk to think. And so I couldn't take everything he said as gospel.
Oh, yeah.
Because he might just be saying it just to see how it sounds when it comes out of his mouth. And then tomorrow, he may even forget he said it. Or, you know, the next day, whatever. And he's also an 8 on the Enneagram. And so whenever he is doing this, he's very passionate about
it. It's authoritative, probably.
Oh, 100%. Like, it's very, and we say it's 8 talking because the volume gets louder, you know, and all of the things. And I'm like, you sounded like this was the gospel truth. And he's like, I didn't really mean that. I was just, he was just talking.
Just talking it out.
But I think it's helpful for me to even think about that sometimes in this process. It doesn't mean this stuff is garbage that's coming out or whatever. It's like, but we're processing.
Yeah.
We're trying to figure it out. Do I actually believe this? Do I actually think this? Do I want to keep going in this direction or not? One of the things that you said in the book, a few times that caught my attention because my therapist helped me with this language again, like probably 50 years ago, was when I was starting to go through this process. And she said, well, you and Jesus, you're just going to have to figure out what stays and what goes. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like mortified at the beginning. Cause I was like, everything stays. Mm-hmm. Duh.
Yeah.
You know, like, or I could have been in a spot where I was like, everything goes.
Yeah, it all goes.
It all goes. But this idea of, and you bring it up too, of what stays and what goes. And it may be, you may go through a season where something stays and the next season you think it should go.
Yeah,
or
absolutely.
Vice versa. 100%.
I
mean, what is that? I mean, as much as you want to share, like, what has that been like for you or what have you seen? How do you feel that that is helpful in this process?
I think, you know, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think that is our natural inclination as humans. If we see something that is wrong, what we perceive as wrong or incorrect, we want to eradicate it, right? But so, like so much of life, the faith that we built as children with the help of whoever built it with us or in teenager years or whenever, that is more nuanced than just, you know, cutting everything out. And listen, I do think cutting everything out is the correct answer for some people. I know people who have been so traumatized by organized religion, specifically Christianity, that this is the only way they can survive. So I'm not talking about that, but I'm saying for someone like me who didn't who just got some bad teaching along the way. And that wasn't anyone's fault. It's interesting because like, I'm also having to come to terms with the fact that like my kids are going to go through a process similar to this, because I do think everyone does kind of go through it. And what will be the things that I taught them in earnest, or I taught them without even realizing I was teaching them, that they are going to be like, I don't think mom was right about that. And I want that for them. I would much rather that happen than them subscribe to everything I've ever said. But as far as what's staying and what is going, for me, it was honoring all of the things that came with my particular faith evolution, even the things that were hard, or what I would look back at and go, I cannot believe that I interacted with humans while I believed this thing. And like
I've had so many of those moments.
Wild. You know, Marie Kondo is the one who talks about, you know, what stays, what goes, and like thanking the thing before you throw it out for its service or whatever. And I think that as cheesy as that is, I do think that that's important, because you had to be upfront about the things you did while you were trying to figure it out.
That's right.
And you have to come to terms with those things. And working through that, I think, is one of the best ways that we can go, okay, like maybe this thing was really helpful to me and really important for me when I was such and such age, or when I was going through such and such thing. But now I don't know that I need it anymore. And I think it needs to stay here. And that is okay to do. It's that we don't have to just toss everything out and say, well, to heck with it, we're done.
Yeah. No, I think that's really great. I wasn't in the Marie Kondo phase. I think it would have stressed me out.
Oh yeah, 100%. Like, I was like, this is not for me.
I think it totally would have stressed me out. But I do like that idea, even as I'm thinking about it metaphorically, of just like thanking the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before.
Or the person.
That's right.
Or the, yeah. I mean, and look, some people do bad things. Some people believe bad things and teach bad things. And that is also 100% important to acknowledge. But I think for me, it was the availability to go, I'm going to pick up this rock. What's underneath this rock? Ooh, I'm putting this rock back down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 For sure. Now this has got me thinking about one of the other metaphors. Now I will say, even though we have our Oklahoma, Texas connection, this is so funny. I still was kind of like, yeah, but I wasn't like, I didn't live in the country.
Okay.
Like some of my family lived in the country. I mm-hmm. lived in town.
Okay. So you were fancy.
So, right. Because we have a Walmart. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. The Walmarts are an important decider.
Like the Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
so everyone who lived in the country had to come to town.
Oh yeah.
Which the Walmart was like a mile and a half from my house. Mm-hmm. So yes, was I fancy? The answer, Aaron, is yes.
100% you were.
I was
fancy. You should
fancy.
Own that. Okay.
I do to this day. Reba and I own it together. I don't listen to country, but I do know that. And obviously Reba's from Oklahoma. So point for Oklahoma. But my point is, now that we get there, I didn't live in the country, but I had cousins who did. And mm-hmm. they did controlled burns.
Mm-hmm.
That you talk about in the book. And so it was like a little familiar to me. I remember kind of like freaking out, driving out the 20 or 30 minutes that it took to get, because there's not much difference between fancy and country.
No.
You know, in not, rural Oklahoma.
Not in Oklahoma or the Texas Panhandle. You're exactly right.
There's not. There's 20 minutes between
there's
Walmart.
There's a Walmart.
There's 20 minutes between Walmart and controlled burn territory. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that's where we were. So it took 20 minutes to get out to controlled burn territory. But it used to freak me out as a kid to see the aftermath of it.
Oh, yeah.
But also to see it happening, because you're just driving down these two-lane highways in rural Oklahoma, and you look over and it's burning.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's burning.
Yes.
Real life burning. And then after, it is black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Everything is charred.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousins, who had more sense than me because they, you know, understood these kinds of things, had no fear mm-hmm. about it at all. But I was afraid of everything. And so, of course, I had fear of these controlled burns. But just like the the therapist language or the Marie Kondo language of what stays and what goes, I really appreciated your controlled burn metaphor in this. So I wonder if you would talk about it a little bit, yeah. Not just the burning part, but the aftermath.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, like our part of the country where we grew up, it does not boast a lot of accessible beauty is what I like to say. You've got to work for it a little bit.
I need that phrasing. I need that phrasing so much. I will interject momentarily and say my husband moved to Central Oklahoma. We met at OU and he moved there he did graduate work there after he had lived his whole life in Colorado.
Oh my gosh. Bless his heart.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the bless his heart. So I need that phrasing.
Yeah.
Does not boast.
Accessible beauty.
Beauty.
Yeah. So,
yes.
But I mean, it is a lovely part. I mean, it is beautiful. I love it because I grew up in it and, you know, I grew up 10 miles from the second largest canyon in the country, which is Powder Canyon. It's stunning.
So it's just, love that canyon.
But
so
it's
beautiful.
Just not like, it's not as, you don't look at it and go, oh, just like Colorado, just beauty everywhere. But I think it's enormously dry and we are a tinderbox for wildfires. I think I say this in the book, but I don't remember a boy that I grew up with who didn't either almost start a wildfire or did start a wildfire. That was just something that was happened to us a lot. Like when I was writing the book, we had one of the worst wildfire seasons in like a decade back at home. And so forestry scientists, right, they observed this indigenous practice of a controlled burn or a prescribed fire, which I also love that phrasing. Mm-hmm. So essentially what it is, if you're unfamiliar, you pre-burn the land in a very structured and organized way so that an untended campfire or a lightning strike doesn't cause an out of control and dangerous fire. These wildfires, when I tell this to people, they're like, okay, yeah, like a wildfire, whatever. Yeah, these fields will burn at the rate of a football field a second. Like it's out of control and it's completely devastating to the communities around it. And so there are a lot of reasons that we do those and why we did them on our ranch land. You know, it's going to burn away all the detritus that is like that tinderbox for a wildfire. That's just going to it's going to keep fueling it. It will restore habitats. It will help rid the land of invasive species. And my favorite thing about it is that when a controlled burn is finished, you mentioned that it's just completely black. That ash is fertilizer. It is a natural fertilizer, and it is going to help new things grow in a more healthy way than they were previously. And I really think that a lot of this process is a controlled burn for spirituality. Like, let's work out these questions and doubts and get comfortable with them so that when the lightning strikes our little plot of land, whatever that may be, you know, someone gets sick, parents get a divorce, you know, you lose your job, whatever, even like global things that just affect you. You are in the midst of an out of control wildfire in the middle of that crisis. You are not having to necessarily unpack your giant questions while you're also being traumatized at the same time. And I think, you know, that's not always going to be as clean as it is, but I do think that starting that process in a place of peace, in a place of it's okay to ask these questions, is so good and healthy for us so that we are clear-minded about the things that we are working through.
Gosh, Erin, that's so good. First of all, just name that I had to look up detritus the first time I read it in your book.
I used to call it detritus. So
no shame about that. I did. I may have pushed the button on so I could see how to pronounce it. Anyway, yeah. And I wrote the little thing. I'm such a dork. I like wrote it out to the side and I was like, oh, she's going to keep using this. So I had to keep reminding myself what it was. So anyway, side note, I learned a new vocab word, but this, I think part of what's so helpful, books like yours, conversations like this, culturally, where this is becoming a more acceptable thing to talk about deconstruction, mm-hmm. is that because because starting the deconstruction process in and of itself can feel very traumatic. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Can feel like the lightning strike.
100%.
And then you're paper bagging. I mean, we're mixing all these metaphors, right? You're paper bagging it or plastic bagging it. You're burning, you know, all of these things at the same time. And so I think that this controlled burn picture is so helpful for me because it allows us to take a step back and say, okay, this isn't that things aren't going to burn,
mm-hmm.
but it can be that we can pull back and say, okay. And for me, not everyone's personality is like this. For me, it's helpful. Like, okay, how can I do this? How can the burning part, maybe intentional is the wrong words, I feel like, but it's just like, how can we do this where it doesn't maybe feel so chaotic, where we mm-hmm. can look at people around us? You know, I think that's part of it. Yes, we're going to lose, probably going to lose some relationships or at least the intimacy level of some of those because people may not understand where we are. We're in different places now. And I'll say in evangelicalism, a lot of times the belief system, the structure, like having that shared is what makes the intimacy in mm-hmm. some of those, you know,
absolutely.
Places and those contexts. And so if that starts to disappear, then some of those relationships feel less intimate. But mm-hmm. just to have this place where you go, okay, this isn't something like me. I don't have to be afraid of this when this is coming. I can be more like my cousins and say, no, this is actually just part of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this because we know, my cousin might say, my dad knows that if he doesn't do this and something like that happens, our house could catch on fire.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and so 100%. This is actually a protectant mm-hmm. for some of these things over here that we know are valuable, that we want to keep safe because, mm-hmm. but we know that this is just part of how nature works. It
absolutely.
Revitalizes itself. It does these things. And sometimes we have to be present for this burn, and they're mm-hmm. they're watched fires. I mean, people are taking care of these.
Oh yeah, what's crazy? I'll never forget the first time I ever saw one, and it was same thing. Driving down a 2-lane highway, you know, fire on either side, and I remember passing by. You know, like you know, we also lived in Tornado Alley, so mm-hmm. it was a regular occurrence to see old men outside on their porches just staring at the sky 100%. To watch.
Yes.
And not go to safety. But it was the same thing. It was just, there were just a ton of people just standing there watching the fire. And I was like, they going to do anything about that? And my dad was like, no, that's how they do it. You know, that's bringing these benefits along with it. And so they have it contained and they have a certain spot that they want it. And they're going to put it out as soon as it, you know, as soon as it gets to where they want to be. And so I was just like, well, that sounds wild. That is not what they talked about on stop, drop, and roll day at elementary school. This is not, doesn't seem right.
That was not included in our fire safety.
Bad.
No,
it was
for
bad.
Sure. But yeah, I love thinking about that. Like, yeah, just how you put that was so great. Gosh, anyway, it's taking my mind a lot of different places about like this is going to burn though.
Oh yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it's what I also like about a controlled burn or a prescribed fire is that the burning is the point.
Ah.
you know, like there are things that needed to go.
Yeah.
And it's, you don't have to be surprised that it's burning. It is absolutely burning. And there's a purpose behind that too. So I think that's an important thing to remember in it as well.
No, I do too. I do too. I agree. Thanks for that. I mean, we've talked around it a little bit. But I'm curious, there are things that need to burn. There's the what stays and what goes. There's the questions. And I guess I'm curious what you've seen in your faith evolution as you moved. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily need to be the catalyst, like what happened, but like as you've moved from the spaces where you talk quite a bit about this in the book, and I can relate to it, where there's a lot of stuff that's just real binary, you know, mm-hmm. it's either right or wrong. It is black or white. It is truth or it isn't truth. mm-hmm. You know, those kinds of things, and then moved into some spaces that maybe were more like question oriented, as we've talked about, or more nuanced. I think I could tell, I won't here, but I could tell my own story about how some of that foundational stuff remained helpful, but also how some of it really did need to go. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious how you have experienced some of that, like how you have experienced some of those foundational, you know, mustard carpet, you know, church kind of things as being helpful. And then also, you know, how did you begin to realize some of that needed to shift for you?
So I think for me, you know, those binaries, those certainties, catechisms, those types of things, they were developmentally appropriate. And I don't mean that age-wise, I mean that spiritually. I don't necessarily know, like you can't explain to an 8-year-old, and I know this because I've tried, that some people believe Adam and Eve were real and it 100% happened just like that. And some people believe that Adam and Eve are metaphors, and that both of those viewpoints can have scripture that support them.
Yeah.
Like their brains.
That's a tough sell for an 8-year-old.
It's not that they're stupid. It's right. That their brains aren't working in that nuance yet. And so I think that's why some of this is natural. You know, Julian of Norwich, who's my favorite weird mystic, talks about like first the fall, then the recovery from the fall, and both are the mercy of God. And I love that because I think it's so helpful to remember that this is normal, like 100%. This is normal. We see people in scripture going through this process. We see people that we love and respect going through this process. We just have a name for it now. We've called it deconstruction, but it's been around for forever. And that is something that I think was really helpful to me to kind of, as I was kind of learning more and going back to the gospels and going back through church history and history of Christianity to go, none of this is new. Not one thing about this is new. The Reformation is a deconstruction. You know, the Great Schism is a deconstruction. I would even say that Jesus's, you know, appearance as Messiah was a deconstruction of the Jewish faith. And so I think it's so helpful to remember that. And we're not going to call Jesus not a good Jew, because he was. It was a different lens that he brought to the table to go, hey, you think I'm here to like free you from Rome, to set up another kingdom? I'm here for your heart, actually, to set up like a different kind of kingdom. And it wasn't that any of it was untrue. They were looking at it the wrong way. We are all looking at it the wrong way. So I think that has been so helpful to me to go, this is a part of what it means to live a life of faith. It's not outside of the norm. It's not crazy or anything like that. It's just a part of it.
There was a professor I had who I should have written down which percentage you use, but it's like the percentage amount of time that we're wrong. This guy said, he was an Old Testament professor, and mm-hmm. he said, in our theology, well, actually, he backed it up. He quoted a different professor from mm-hmm. our seminary, and he said, and this guy was wrong. And, you know, you're kind of like, what? And then he goes, wow. And he goes, and you know what? He goes, and you are too.
Yeah.
And then mm-hmm. he said, and so am I.
Mm-hmm.
And then he used a very generous percentage. I think mine is much, much greater. But he said, here's the deal. We're all wrong.
Yes.
At least 10% of the time.
Oh, I have to believe it's more than that.
Me too. But then this is this is the twist. He said, we're all wrong about 10% of the time. The problem is none of us know which 10%.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And
that's why I struggle with people who say things like the Bible is clear.
Oh,
I want to go.
The Bible is clear. Yellow flag. Red flag.
Yeah, it's a red flag for me because I go, this is an ancient collection of books that are so, like, they say one thing on one page and then you flip a couple of chapters over and it's saying a completely different thing. So let's not act like We know that our interpretation that, you know, throughout the years of 2000 years of Christianity, that our denomination has got it perfect.
Thank you.
And everyone else is going to, you know, probably go to a lower circle of heaven. Maybe, you know, something like
maybe
that.
Maybe lower than that.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. You're 100% right. So I think that's why I like, that's, I mean, and part of this is like, it doesn't, I don't address specific questions in the book because it's not really about what your questions are. It's about coming to terms with the fact that you're not going to get the answers to some of them. And you have to figure out how to be okay with that or not. But that is something that you have to deal with to go, oh, the certainty is what I was clinging to. And that doesn't actually exist where I thought it did.
No, that's so true. Becca McNeil in her first book called it certainty worship. And I just like hate that that resonated with me.
Oh, 100%. Well, it feels safe. It feels comfortable. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I do think there is something like it needs to be addressed and needs to be noticed.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I'm trying to think. There were so many. I don't want to spoil any of the funny parts. I'm almost embarrassed at how many like laugh out loud pieces, but also the footnotes, Erin, I could not handle it. I love a Chuck
Klosterman footnote situation.
I love a good footnote. I also may have, I don't, can I even say this? I hollered at my husband. I said, "Hun, do you know something about a contra code?"
Oh, the Konami code? Yeah. And he said it, didn't he? He
did 100%. No, he immediately said it. He immediately, yes. He's like, "What, you mean?" And then he did. And I was like, oh mm-hmm. my goodness, this is where we are right now. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, this is where we are. But anyway, so I'm like, I'm trying not to spoil all the things. Maybe where I'll try and like bring our plastic bag down back to the parking lot where I'll try to land this plane is because I want to maybe repeat what you just said, because I think that it's so good for the book, but also for this conversation, for the larger conversation, that even though it does feel like it sometimes, and it's not, I know that you weren't meaning to say this and I'm not either. It's like, it's not that some of these individual things aren't important, but it really isn't about these individual questions. Like bigger part is like, do we have permission to even ask them?
Oh, 100%. Do we have permission to step outside of what we thought the answers were?
Yes.
Do we have permission to change our minds?
Right.
Do we have permission to read scripture in a different way? Do we have permission to understand the words of Jesus in a different way? Yeah. I mean, I think that's really hard, especially when you have grown up or you were youth grouped in a faith that just was like, didn't really offer, hey, lots of people believe this about this, but there are a lot of other really smart people who believe this about this.
Yeah.
And that, and part of, again, that's developmentally appropriate. And I don't know, a lot of denominations are going to be like, well, we believe this, but you know, those guys over there, they believe that. So you could choose which one you want. They don't really do that. But I think it is, there is a need, I think, for some of us, for a permission slip to ask questions and be curious.
Oh yeah, for sure. So with that in mind, and with the book not being a how-to guide, praise God, or a, you know, we're addressing these individual questions, but I would just say, like, based on, you know, some of the folks who, these conversations you alluded to earlier, you know, these online, offline questions, these messages that you get, you've seen a lot of where folks like us are right now, and kind of where we feel like we've been maybe and where we feel like we're going. And so I guess, and I think what's been encouraging to me, I'll preface it like this. I think what's been encouraging to me is that when I started asking more questions, I felt like there weren't many people asking questions. It wasn't actually true.
Right.
I just wasn't connected with them.
Sure.
Because my community, that wasn't really, we didn't have permission in my community to really ask that. And so I just wasn't connected with folks who were. But I would say, as someone who has formed some of those connections, who's been privy to some of those connections, like maybe to help us land the plastic bag, like what would you say to folks if they're like, maybe they're starting this journey, or also maybe they're someone who their best friend is starting in.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, I don't know what to do with this. And so I mean, choose your own adventure. Who would you address? You could address both of them, but what would you say?
You know, I think to the person who's just starting out, I think I would tell them that the work, like working out your faith with fear and trembling, however you want the fear and trembling to look like, it's the work of our lives. Like the idea of, you know, simply existing with a set of beliefs that has not come under any kind of scrutiny, I don't believe is any way to live our life. And let me be clear, it is exhausting. It is frustrating. There is no end point. I think I say this in the book, but there's no, like, you don't get through the first level of Super Mario Brothers and jump on the flagpole and save the princess. Like that doesn't exist in the faith life. Like you don't win. But that's part of this. And I think integrating asking questions into your spiritual practice is so important, as opposed to viewing it as like, I got to figure out what I think about gay marriage. And I got to think about what I figured out about women in leadership. And I got to, you know, biblical inerrancy. Let's talk about that. You know, what's my atonement theory? You know, I don't think, yes, those things are important, but this is not like a class that you have to go through and there's an end to it and you have to take a final. And if you fail your final, then I'm sorry, you will not be with Jesus anymore. This is a life of faith. This is a relationship. And so I think what I hope is that they have that practice of having it out with God, that practice of questioning and doubting and wrestling, that becomes a part of who they are in their faith, as opposed to something separate that they've worked out. You know, and then they can go back to their faith after they're finished. And then I think to the people who are watching their best friend go through something like this, I would just encourage them to be a presence, to leave the judgment at the door, and to offer simply a backboard, just kind of a sounding board, maybe to say, okay, you know, I'm thinking about this. What about this? And I think those types of friendships, those types of relationships, because my husband and I, we went through what I would call our quote unquote deconstructions in different like not at the same time. Yeah. So, you know, when our youngest was born, he was like, I think I'm an atheist. And I was like, oh, not great. Okay. Let's work through that. I have always scored very high on the gift of faith and the spiritual gifts testing. And so that was never really an issue to me. And so about the time that he had come back around after reading all of his philosophers and all of these things and really kind of coming to a spot where he felt like he could rest in God and in the mystery, it was my turn to go. And so we were like, well, great. I hope this works out. But it, you know, I think just being there for someone, asking questions with them and leaving a judgment. I think, and even when, and I think this is really hard. I see this a lot with parents, not my parents, but I see this a lot with people who grew up in faith, is that their parents feel like anytime they're, you know, they change their mind on something, that's an indictment to whatever they believed beforehand. And there, you know, it's, oh, well, I didn't do a good job, or I'm so sorry that I, you know, instead of just going, hey, I hear what you're saying. And I don't necessarily view that as an indictment on my character or how I raised you. And so I think that is what is difficult too, to go, well, I'm not going to, it's the same thing as like when you parent your own kids in front of your parents and the things that you do differently, they're like, well, what? We didn't do that. Why are you doing that? And it's like, why didn't, I don't think that was a great idea what you did, or I'm just choosing to do it differently. Those are two completely valid things to say, and it doesn't have to necessarily be because you were wrong. It can be because I just want to do it a different way, or I have different ideas and other things have influenced me to make me want to understand this in a different way.
Yeah. I think that's really great, Erin. And I appreciate you sharing about you and your husband too, because that has been one of the things that's been rolling around in my head, is that when we go through this at different times than the people, other people in our lives. But also, as you mentioned, like this isn't, a lot of people our age are hitting this, you know, now and have been for a few years and will, you know, for a few years also. But as you mentioned, like this is not, it's not like an age thing. We don't, it's not like a you know, it's a faith development thing. And it just looks very, you know, it just looks very different and it looks different for everybody. And so, yeah, so I appreciate you sharing that too. Oh my goodness. I feel like we could almost do a part two and we say, skip the book and we'll just talk about how Oklahoma is Diet Texas, but we don't, you know, but this has been so great. I'll say the name of the book and everything again, and then you can say the release date.
Yes. Yeah. February 4th. But listen, get those pre-orders in because one of the pre-order bonuses is the audiobook. Yeah, that's like a secret. I mean, not really. It's going to come out in a couple of weeks, but it, by the time this airs, it will be. Right. And you know, and you also get some other fun things, but that audiobook, that's, I was really
did you record it?
I did record it. Yes.
That's so fun. I was hoping, I mean, like podcast hosts, like you would, you know, like that would be a thing. But I did chat with someone the other day who said, an author who said that he did not pass his test.
Yeah. They will make some authors, they'll make them audition. And I used to do voiceover work. You know, there is, I was a theater major and, you know, every once in a while we'll get something that works in our just so rare though.
And you just grab that.
Yeah. And you're like, grab that chocolate chip.
You're like, yes, that's the one. That's the one. Oh my goodness. This has been way too much fun. I've spent this time with Erin Hicks Moon. Her new book is coming out on February 4th called I've Got Questions, The Spiritual Practice of Having It Out with God. Pre-order it. I will also say, I mean, the foreword by Sarah Bessie.
Listen,
that's worth the pre-order bonuses
right there. I cannot even handle it.
I mean, that's where I started laughing. I was like, oh, this is going to be good.
She's so great.
This is going to be so fantastic.
She was very generous. I loved it
so much. Anyway, congrats on it. Erin, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you so much, Alexis. This was great.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.